Welcome to Chai with Samdosa. I have a podcast which is available on iTunes, Spotify, and major other podcast platforms globally. Today I have a great TEDx speaker, a keynote speaker, all the way from the United States of America. I'll give you a little bit about Jonathan Goldson. He is a rabbi, as well as he got a great bio. I'm just not going to justify if I'm going to talk to you verbally on this, but I'll give you a snippet of that. He's a director of Ethical Imperatives. He's a teaching professional where he teaches ethics is good business and the benefit of intellectual diversity. As I said, he is a TEDx speaker, a keynote speaker, a trainer, a coach, a community rabbi. Well, it goes on. So why don't we just welcome him to my podcast, Chai with Samdosa, today. Welcome.
Thank you, Sam. Delighted to be with you.
Great to hear from you. And thank you for accepting my invitation to be on my podcast today. So let's begin, and I would like you to tell my audience who is Jonathan and what is his purpose in this transient world.
Oh my, that's quite a
heavy question.
Quite a question.
Yeah.
Well, give you the thumbnail sketch goes like this. I graduated from the University of California with a degree in English. Of course, a degree in English is very useful if you use it for what I used it for, which was to go hitchhiking across the United States for about half a year, across the Atlantic, went backpacking across Europe, ended up in Israel, and that's where I connected for the first time in my life with my Jewish roots. I discovered a vibrant society filled with depth and meaning and purpose. And changed the trajectory of my life. I stayed in Israel for 9 years. Met my wife there. We had our first two children there. Studied the ancient wisdom of Jewish tradition. Became an Orthodox rabbi. Wow. And then I embarked on my teaching career, teaching high school students, Jewish high school students. Wanted to impart to them the wisdom and the insights that I had acquired to help them find their own direction in life. Taught for 1 year in Budapest, Hungary. Two years in Atlanta, Georgia, and 20 years in St. Louis, where I live now. And when my school closed 4 years ago, the victim of politics, like so much of what we see today, I had to decide what I wanted to do when I grew up. So I started a business as a professional speaker. And I wanted to take 3,000 years of wisdom that I'd been studying and teaching for so many years and translated into a presentation that would be relevant for a general audience. And so when I looked at the universal values and tried to distill them down into a single message, I came up with ethical leadership and intellectual diversity. And so my calling now is to help business leaders in particular see why good ethics is good business, but also to spread the message of how good ethics is the formula for success in every aspect of our lives. All our relationships are built on a foundation of ethics, and everything that we do in life is built around relationships. So Absolutely. If we get our relationships right, we can't help but succeed.
Absolutely. This, when you say ethical imperative and diversity, is quite a big chunk in our society. And when we talk about ethical, and that very lot of question raises in that sort of what is the definition of ethical business? Why I have to be ethical? But the person with whom I'm doing a business is not ethical, is not doing those sort of things. So why should I be a good guy and paying taxes to the government and paying taxes to a lot of people, but the next door business owner does not do it and he's making more money? How we can balance these sort of things out? How you project this in your presentation?
No, you really touched on several different topics just now, and let's start with a starting point, which is really how do we define ethics?
Just one.
And second. That's actually.
Can you hold for 1 second?
Yes.
Sorry about that. That was my daughter just came in from the school.
Yes, that happens.
Sure, go ahead.
So that opens up quite a bit of discussion, and let's start at the beginning. What are ethics? And there are a few different ways to approach it, but the definitions I've come up with recently or focused in on recently is recognizing our place in the world, how our actions affect others, and our responsibility to those who share our world. You know, there's so much talk today about rights, but if I'm demanding my rights and you're demanding your rights, we're going to be bumping heads again and again and again. But if I'm taking responsibility to look out for your rights and you're taking responsibility to look out for my rights, then we're not going to have any problems. Now, of course, in theory, it's a lot more simple than it is in practice. But if we start with that mindset, and that's why I talk about an ethical mindset, as opposed to trying to develop, you know, in business, we have these compliance laws. And they're necessary and they're important. The problem is that compliance can be the enemy of ethics. Because if we try to legislate doing what's right, then we end up absolving ourselves of the responsibility to try to grapple with difficult situations and difficult questions. And so we need that structure, but that's the beginning, that's not the end. And so when it comes down to business, it's true, we are going to have to deal with unethical people at times, but there are more and more studies all the time about how businesses that have a culture of ethics, a culture of trust, they are the best places to work as ranked by Fortune 100. They are the most successful businesses according to a number of different rubrics and studies. And that when you don't have a culture where the community of the business are on board with the mission, when they are comfortable and committed to one another, when they trust that they're being looked out for and that they'll get credit and they're appreciated. When you have a community like that, everything just moves smoothly. And you have more loyalty, you have more passion, you have more productivity. And it is inevitable that you will do better over the long term. Is the mistake we make is to think that we have to choose between being good and doing what's right. I'm sorry, I didn't phrase that properly. We have to choose between being good and being successful.
Yeah, I think you also touch a lot of areas of where ethical business also bring in great values. If you have values which align with your vision, which aligned with your understanding as how you want to take your business to next level, that will also bring in the right people to work with you, and it will become a family. It will not look like a manufacturing plant where you are bringing in people every year, recycling them, bringing somebody else to come in. You will become like a family, and people will stick to it, and they will enjoy every moment of it because they are being valued. They are valued. Are being aligned with the company's values as well. Correct.
That's exactly right. I mean, if they feel that what they're doing is important and they're recognized for it, that does make them happy in the workplace, because purpose is the determinant of happiness. When I feel that my life means something, I'm connected to something greater than myself, and the time I invest in what I'm doing is making a positive difference in the world, I want to be there. I mean, just consider the cost of turnover. It's you know, it's staggering. And then even more staggering, the studies done by I forget them. I'm just losing the who did the study, but it'll come to me.
Yeah.
Over $500 billion a year are lost, estimated, to American businesses due to worker employee disengagement and workplace conflict. And why is there disengagement? And why is there conflict? Because people don't feel that what they're doing really makes a difference. And they don't feel that respected and appreciated and trusted.
Yeah, they're not being valued. There are a lot of studies done by Harvard. There are a lot of studies done by McKinsey's. There are a lot of studies done by a lot of other renowned researchers. Granton also does a lot of valuable research upon those sort of things. Within the company's culture, have this particular seed needs to be sowed during that period when somebody comes in, so they can see the culture is very giving culture. It's not been taking culture, because I have worked in corporate for about almost 22 years, and I've seen there is no such a thing where, you know, you are just a number. You are just being counted as a number. You are not counted as an asset. If you count as an asset to this company, you can see there are wonders going to happen, because that person will not feel like that he has to come 9 to 5. He will say, oh, you know, I'm excited to be at work. I'm excited to do those things what I'm doing. I'm excited to helping several hundred people within that company, within that culture which I am in. And I really, they will become then ambassadors. They will not become an employee. They will become an ambassador, because they will be talking, whether walking, talking, sleeping, eating, every time they're talking about their company, and people will be completely mesmerized how much love he got for his company, because he has been given that much love. So he feels that that's his company. I'm not actually working for somebody, because this is my company. I'm building my company. I'm not building anybody else's company. So this sort of a culture needs to be governed by the leadership, is governed by everybody else who are there, and they have been given this what I call it a guidance or training from the beginning, that this is a company which values you as an individual, because you are an asset to our company.
And of course that's going to be transmitted naturally to clients and customers. And they're going to pick up, you know, Simon Sinek has this very compelling story he tells about going into a Starbucks in the Four Seasons. And there's this fellow behind the counter. He's personable. He's chatting. He's making jokes. He's just, everybody's having a great time talking to this guy. And so Simon Sinek says to him, so you like your job? He says, I love my job. He says, what do you love about it? He says, you know, my bosses, they come in. They know me by name. They say, how are things going? Everything okay? Can we do anything to help you? I work in the afternoons in a different restaurant, in a different coffee shop. And there, I keep my head down, because the bosses are always looking to catch us doing something wrong. They're always, if they speak to us, it's criticized. They don't know who we are. So you got the same guy doing the same job in two different places. And in one place, he loves it, and he's providing a tremendous customer experience. And in the other place, he's trying to be as anonymous as possible. How's that going to affect the customer experience? And that, as you said, it starts with the leadership. It's a top-down flow that shapes the culture of any community.
Absolutely. And I was already spoken to this one gentleman who was running a billion-pound business over here in the UK, which has been closed down because of the COVID, as well as because of the internal politics, because it was a family-owned business, and a person who has spent his entire life, 23, 24 years, to build this business, to create a great relationship with employees, with customers, on this ethical basis, as we are discussing. And he only used to phone people And they used to do the job because they hear him saying that he's part of this journey. His old employees were working there as a family, not as an employee. They were saying, okay, what you say, we understand, we can take this on board and we'll complete the task. And that's what is happening. And again, there was things happens, you know, you are not all, you, we are humans and we are going to make mistakes. We are not robots. And robots are built by humans as well. And they're going to make mistakes as well. If we will put a single, a dot or a comma into the programming, it will make a mistake. So we are all humans, correct? So we will make a mistake and make mistakes happen. And acknowledging that mistake is very important. You know, you just say, you know what? I raised my hand. I did a mistake, you know, and I will take care of that. And I will try to solve that problem. It's not that blaming somebody else. And that's where the culture started to get it corrupt and started to start happening so much so that you working in that company as a and an asset becomes a number. And then say, you know what, I'm just a number. I would rather go from here.
Yeah, you very interesting you say that. I've been telling this story a lot lately. I just heard it a few weeks ago. About a fellow who came into work. He was 13 minutes late. And his boss berated him in front of all of his colleagues. Said, what do you think you're doing coming in late? If you do this again, you're not going to have a job. You have a responsibility. You need to take this job seriously. Well, this fellow had never been late before since he started working. He was going through some serious personal problems. He was going through a divorce. He had some serious medical problems. He was a guy who had taken work home with him. He had stayed late to finish jobs. And in that instant, he made up his mind. I'm never going one iota beyond what's required of me. I'm not respected. I'm not appreciated. I'm not putting in any more to this job than I have to. And I'm going to wait and just ride it out until I find something better. Now, your point is that it didn't have to end there. Maybe the boss was having a bad day. Maybe he got some terrible news. Maybe he hadn't slept that night. Here he was under pressure. But he could have come in the next day and said publicly in the same forum, I really have to apologize. Fred is a great worker. I appreciate that. I was having a really bad day and I had no right to take it out on you. And I apologize, and I want you to know how much your contribution to this company means to me. He could have fixed it.
Yeah.
But he probably wasn't even aware that he'd done anything that needed fixing, which, of course, is so much of the problem as well.
Yeah, so it's about ego. It's about emotional intelligence. That's why I dwell upon doing a lot of emotional intelligence with a lot of people saying, okay, do a lot of, just do a questionnaire. It's just a 10 question questionnaire. Just do the questionnaire. You know, it tells you where you stand on your emotional intelligence journey. You know, it tells you how you're going to answer the question as well. You just described this story. That manager would have taken a step back, one step back. I think you must have read a book for Stephen Covey, where he talked about this scenario, this particular scenario, not this particular scenario. So he described the scenario like this. He says, a man is getting ready to go to work and his daughter is having his breakfast, her breakfast at the table. Wife is in the kitchen preparing lunch and everything. And while he came down, a little girl spilled the juice on dad's trousers. And he got really, really angry. So now the daughter is crying. He has to rush up to get his trousers changed. At that similar time, the school bus came where he used to drop the daughter off and go to his work. So the bus has already left. By the time he came back, everything is a very big hoo-ha. He did not say bye to his wife properly. He rushed in his car, went to the school, dropped his daughter, did not say bye to her as well. Reached the office and then realized that he had left his briefcase at home. And the whole day went like this, that he did not have a chance to speak to his wife properly. And he had a really, really nasty day. So then the student Kevin said, okay, why don't we just pause over here? Let's repeat the same scenario. Again, the same scenario. woke up in the morning, came down while his daughter was having his her breakfast, and she spilled the juice. Instead of getting irritated or showered, he said, "Darling, next time be careful." He cleaned it up, he went upstairs, changed his trousers, he said bye to her, bye to his wife, went out, dropped his daughter to the school bus. Everything was hunky-dory. It will take about a split second just to control your emotions. Because we are not self-aware about our own emotions. So how are we going to control it? And that's the first pillar of emotional intelligence, to be self-aware of it. And if you are a leader, and with this COVID-19, you have to make a very serious decisions. I mean, you can understand people, you are putting people on furlough, and now you are thinking of, you know, after 6 months, I don't want that person. How am I going to say to that person, we don't want you? Or you need to apply. You have worked in a company for 17, 18 years, and they have put you on furlough, and now they are saying to you, by the way, your job is gone now. We don't have a job. If you want your job, you need to apply again for the job. The scenario is very terrible to those people who has been working in the company and waiting for the pension to come along. Because government are not doing, now government has, I read an article on Guardian, and government pushing people to come back to work. They're pushing companies to put people coming back to work because they are losing revenue. Nobody's doing a train journey. So a lot of revenue is going downhill at the moment because they are thinking people will start coming to commute to work. So they will increase the fare again in January. Nobody's interested because if I'll give you a 6 months when you have been told not to come to work and you're working at home, around your family, around your children, and everything has been laid out now, and then they are asking you to change that scenario. Jumping on the train or in a car or something like that, spending 2-3 hours, go to work and come back, and then you start the same journey again. How many people are going to acknowledge that and say, no, that's not me, I'm not going to do that, correct? So leadership has to understand what is making your employees, the moral of your employees, or the emotional connection of your employees are really important to the business or not.
Yeah, and take another scenario. Yes. You know, people who are forced to work from home, it's an adjustment. They have their kids, they have all kinds of distractions. It's much harder to be disciplined in your house, especially teachers, where the whole dynamic is completely different. So what are some things that are going on? They're burdening teachers with additional paperwork to try to ensure they're doing their jobs. And in the process, they're making it what was now twice as hard to do the job is now becoming three times, four times, five times harder to do the job. So why not show your teachers, why not show your employees? We realize this is hard. We trust you that you're going to do your best to make as much as you can of this situation. We're going to do whatever we can to support you. Let's work together. Let's have open lines of communication so we can hear what's going on, what the problems are, what the successes are, and together we can do the best we can in a situation that is far from ideal. I mean, I worked in a school for 2 years where there was an adversarial relationship between the principal and the staff, and it was toxic. We couldn't do our best job teaching because we were so preoccupied with this political back and forth. And then I left that job. I came to another job where I stayed for 20 years. Exactly the opposite. I talk about it in my keynote speech about what it meant to us to have a principal that we knew always had our backs, was always there for us. He knew that putting the teachers first would put the students first. Because if the teachers are empowered and supported to do their jobs, the students are the ones who are going to benefit. And it's the same thing in business. The leaders who are responsible for for the people who serve the customers, the clients, their job is to make sure that those people are supported and empowered and feel trusted and appreciated. If, you know, it's the job of leaders to figure that out and to be honest about their own shortcomings. You know, sometimes you have to tell an employee, you know, business is shutting down. We can't keep everything the way it is. We may have to let you go, but we want you to know that it's the only way we can keep our doors open. And the moment things turn around or we figure out a way to reverse this, you have a place to come back to. That person's still going to have to deal with not getting paid, but the whole emotional state of mind is going to be so different. And it's going to be so much easier for them to accept that reality than if they feel like they're simply being cast aside.
I think COVID-19, it just popped in my mind, you know, with COVID-19, if we have open doors or open hands to work together, all the businesses to work together, we would have less people losing their jobs. Let's say, for example, you have a manufacturing plant and you decided because of this, I can't actually manage it, for example, but you have your staff who has a quality skill set which can be utilized in somewhere else by the time everything goes over. You know, if we have worked in that sort of a mindset of working in collaborative manners, we would have done a lot of great effort to actually execute better results for this COVID-19. We wouldn't have been gone through with in a completely dire situation where millions of people have lost their jobs and they are continuing losing their jobs right now. How much government is going to print money? Enough is enough. Government is printing money like a water. They are printing money every day. Billions of dollars, billions of pounds are being printed. They are circulating money because that's how they are seeing it. We are in a triple dip recession at the moment. Every country going through with it. And still we are looking at how we are going to compete against each other within the business. You know, if you know that, okay, Sam Dosa is a speaker, he's also this and that, okay, how I can collaborate and we can start with some sort of a workshop online to let's bring people in just to capture some information. If it is just the beginning of something, we might be able to connect to so many great people on this journey, and we can connect with them. It might not be, it's just a visibility, like you have connected with me and we are talking over here. It's just a visibility. Yeah. What comes behind this whole just visibility, it will be enormous things. And that's where people are not doing collaboration. People are still thinking, you know what, I need to compete against them. But you can't compete against me. My skill sets are completely different than your skill sets. And vice versa. We are both have a completely different skill set. You have a mammoth of experience behind you, which you can share. And I can bring in something else. And we come from completely two different cultures as well. Those cultures can combine together and we can bring something greater things as well. So I think leadership has to understand competitiveness is there. We are always going to be competitive. We have this ingrained thing in us. We need to compete against. But you can't compete against similar things which is happening in the world right now.
Yeah, and you know the history of mankind certainly as a biblical scholar, I see this as the history of the Jewish people, and it plays out in so many aspects of human society that there are two ways to create unity. One is through external pressure, and the other is through internal cohesion. And when you look at history, it's time after time after time of external pressure, a common enemy, a common problem, a crisis, a plague, a war, an economic meltdown. People come together because of the desperation of the moment. And then as soon as the crisis passes, what should happen is that we say, okay, now that we're together, let's stick together. let's be committed to preserve this sense of camaraderie, of collegiality, of partnership. But what happens is that we become victims of our prosperity. I mean, look at the things we are fighting about today. You know, you talk to someone from the Middle Ages. You try to describe to them our problems. They couldn't even begin to explain to understand what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Because for them, every day was survival and wicked, powerful people and acts of nature and hand to mouth. And it doesn't mean that our problems aren't real problems. It just means keeping a little perspective.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And being appreciative of all the things we have that make our lives good and building on the foundations that we have. Take advantage of all the blessings that are available to us.
That's the key thing, you know. We stop counting our gratitudes. We stop counting our blessings. We stop out counting, you know, how full we're grateful we should be, you know. Yeah, so we have a roof over our head. We have a technology. I was listening, and I was saying that in 1826 or 18, there was a very big a plague came in. Millions of people passed away at that time as well. And there was not sort of this sort of a technology. People would still have to incubate and still have to stay in the house. There was no other choices for them. But we have this entire, the country was completely giving you all this opportunity of connecting with people. More and more PR people are now connecting online right now. So you can imagine we have been blessed with this technology. If we did not have this technology, what would we have done? You remember your childhood. And if you remember your childhood, you would have been thinking, okay, if I want to play, I would go out and play. Yeah, I brought up in a country where I was outside all the time. My mom and dad used to shout and also come in now at the dinner time. Now we can't force our children to go out from the house because they are stick to this screen. Yeah. And I said to a lot of people, I said to my children as well, you know what? You should be going out. Enjoy outside, fresh air. Nature is clean now. You can imagine 6 months ago, nature was completely polluted. Now nature is completely clean. And we never used to see deers or deers are on the road because this was a road where you can't see those precious animals. Now started seeing those animals because they can't hear this much noise coming through. So they were coming and showing their faces to us. So nature is full of surprises, but we are just close ourselves in these sort of things. You don't want to, you don't want to make sure that you are grateful for a lot of things happening in our life.
You know, in Hebrew, the term for gratitude is hakaras hatov, which literally translates as recognizing the good. And it's so instructive because if you keep your eyes open, you pay attention. I mean, every morning is that when in the Jewish prayers, we have a list of 15 blessings we recite every morning. And each one is focused upon self-awareness. As you might know, what today is called mindfulness.
Yes. Right?
To recount, to make sure that I express appreciation for who I am, what I am, the opportunities I have, the resources I have. I have eyes that can see.
Yes.
I have a mouth that can speak. My body functions are operating. It's the things we take for granted, we stop appreciating. And it's human nature. Our default is that everything should be fine.
Yeah.
And so when I get a pinprick or I have a hangnail or I get a scuff mark on my new shoes, it becomes a crisis. And it's, if we would take a step back and look at it as some kind of perspective, we would be so embarrassed at ourselves for placing so much importance on things that are pretty trivial.
I said one thing always in my conversation. I said, you know, you should be saying thank you to be alive. Because when you go to sleep, you are dead. You are completely dead in your sleep. You are not. You are, even you are turning and toasting in your sleep, but you're still you are not alive, and you can pass away in that sleep. So when you wake up, you should be saying, thank God I'm alive. I'm healthy. I can breathe. I can hear. I can smell, as you said. You know, these are all regular, should be the feature of our getting up in the morning, the gratitude cycle. And it's important.
Think about all the little things. Now, I've been married 32 years. Beautiful. And, you know, marriage is hard work. And one of the reasons it's hard work is because it's very easy for partners to take one another for granted.
Absolutely.
Okay, my wife made me dinner. All right, well, that's her job, right?
Not in this day and age.
Right. Even if we posit it is her job, is that a reason not to say thank you? Is not that a reason not to make her feel that I appreciate what she does for me? And to, you know, it's something I read about a fellow who, they were talking about what was the secret to his long, happy marriage. Is he leaves notes for his wife around the house. And I started doing it. You know, it's so easy with post-it notes. You know, she opens up the cupboard and there's a little, you know, good morning, I love you. Thanks for everything you do. And then I'll do it for a while and then I'll forget. And I'll stop doing it for a while. Right? Because I get into my routine and I forget to notice and I forget to be grateful. And that's on me. Because what right do I have not to appreciate what anyone does for me, all the more so someone whom I love, we've built a life together, we've raised our children together, we support one another. I mean, how insensitive is it of me to not continuously make her feel, make her aware of how appreciative I am, and certainly in the workplace. And you know, it doesn't just have to be bosses for employees. Employees can express appreciation to their bosses.
Absolutely.
I have a place to work.
Absolutely.
I have an income. I'm trusted with responsibility. I'm part of a team. And if something's not going well, I should feel that I'm trusted and respected enough that I can raise a concern. And if I make a mistake, I should feel that I can come forward to admit it and work towards correcting it rather than trying to have to hide it and hope nobody finds out about it. Or if I'm not being successful, or I don't feel confident in the job I've been given, I can ask for help and not feel that it's going to be held against me. I mean, this stuff is, I was on another podcast and the host said to me, this all makes so much sense. Why don't we do it? Which is a very good question. It's because we get so caught up in the short term, in the bottom line, in our own pressures and our own inadequacies, our own difficulties and challenges, that we forget to think about the people who are part of our lives. And we do a disservice to them and we do a disservice to ourselves.
First, we do a disservice to ourselves, even though if you are doing a disservice to yourself, that's why you can't actually see what wrong you are doing to others. Because you are not completely honest with yourself. You are not completely aware of yourself, what's happening. You know, we all are humans, as I said. You know, we are all humans. We are going to make mistakes. Yeah. To avoid those mistakes, start knowing yourself. Start understanding who you exactly are. The biggest question we know, because we are firefighting. Everybody is firefighting. You go into an office and say, you know what, I want to complete this, I want to complete that, I want to make sure. 24 hours is too less time, you know. I should be having at least 30 hours a day. 24 hours. 834,000 seconds. Still not enough. And I said to a lot of people, you know, we should be taking at least 10 minutes out from this entire time to contemplate. Just sit and contemplate. Just sit and quiet. But we don't have 10 minutes to sit. And I was listening to this podcast and somebody says, you know, people who do not have 10 minutes to sit alone, they are the most poorest people in the world. Most poorest people in the world. You have all the wealth in the world, but if you can't have time to sit yourself alone, you do not have a single dime in your hand.
Yeah, you mentioned Stephen Covey a moment ago.
Yes.
And one of his seven habits is, I think it's the last one, I think it's sharpen your axe.
Yes.
And it's a lesson I'm still trying to learn in my life, that you know, here you've got to cut down a tree, you grab the axe. Well, I don't want to waste the time to make sure the axe is sharp. I want to get right to work. Well, by doing that, it's not going to take me three times as long to cut down the tree when I could have invested 10 minutes sharpening the axe and I'd be finished so much earlier.
Absolutely.
And what you just mentioned about taking time off, I mean, it's been demonstrated the benefits of meditation. Nothing spiritual, just sit down, clear your head, focus on your breathing, let your body reacquire some equilibrium.
Yes.
That's sharpening the axe. That's sharpening the mind. Now when I go back to work, I'm going to be so much more efficient and so much more effective. I think it was J.P. Morgan who said, I can do a year's work in 9 months, but not in 12 months. If I take time off to allow myself to recharge, to rejuvenate, to regather my resources, that is part of fulfilling my purpose, achieving my mission, and doing my job. And if I try to fill every moment, what I do is I burn myself out. Then I'm ineffective, I'm frustrated, I'm bitter, I'm resentful, and I get the job done.
But that will not fulfill your fulfilling yourself. You are still burning. You are still burning. What is the effect of the chronic burnout? I've met so many people. I've been through my burnout as well, because in life you go through with so many challenges. I do not say challenges, I say adventures. I've been through so many adventures. And you do get burnout because you get so many responsibilities on yourself and you do not learn, you've forgotten to delegate those tasks to others. Even though your presence, your partner or your wife or your children, you do not delegate. You say, you know, I'll do it. In the business, in the workplace, you know, that will take me 5 minutes to complete. If I'm going to delegate, that person will take half an hour to complete. So you do not delegate. And you take more and more responsibility on yourself. And then you cry about it. And then you rant about it. You know, I do all the work. Nobody gives a monkeys about it. You know, nobody's. And people look at you and you say, you never share anything with us. You never delegate anything with us. How am I going to help you then? Yeah. Then you are crying out loud saying that nobody helps you.
And they don't respect you because you're not respecting them.
Absolutely.
So everybody's miserable.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would like to conclude this our podcast with your one statement which you use in your keynote, where that inspired you in a long run and how you inspired others.
One of my rabbis told me many, many years ago, he'd been living in Israel for a long time, and he went back, his first trip back to the States in many years. And they, if you're old enough, you remember what this was like, they passed out headphones.
Yes.
There was one movie.
Yes.
One screen, they passed out headphones. He hadn't watched a movie in years. And it wasn't part of his lifestyle. And he said, well, I wonder what movies are like these days. And so he listened to, he put in the headphones, he started watching the movie. He said the first thing he thought of was that you, when you're watching a movie, you can always tell when something important is about to happen. Background music. The music starts to swell, and you know that the plot is about to take a dramatic turn. So he said, wouldn't it be great if life had background music? We'd always know when we have to start paying attention, when our choices are really going to make a difference. Problem is, of course, life doesn't have background music. So we have to be alert. Right? We have to imagine that any moment could be a critical moment, that what appears to be a small, perhaps insignificant fork in the road could actually lead me in a radically different direction. And that by thinking of ourselves as players in a story, listen for the voice of the director. Who's the director? What's the director? Our conscience. The conscience is telling us what's right, how we should act, how we should treat people. To not make decisions about what's in my immediate self-interest, but what's in everyone's long-term interest. Because doing what's best for everyone is what's best for me. I make myself better. I contribute to making the world better. And the better the world I live in, the better that is for me. And so to acquire, this is what I call the ethical mindset of trying to see things from other points of view, engaging people who think differently so that we can learn from them, having humility to recognize that maybe there's another way of looking at something, or maybe sometimes I'm wrong. And I need to take a step back, put my ego on the shelf, and start over again. But if we listen for that voice to guide us, it is speaking to us.
Yes.
And we can hear it. And then it's up to us to choose to follow it.
Absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. That's amazing. I think we start wonder about those things. We will be, you know, completely different thought process, mindset, and the way we articulate ourselves will be completely different. Because sometimes when we use our words, we have to be very cautious what sort of word we are saying. Because what are those things? Our tongue, even though it does not have a bone in it, but it's so sharp, it will pierce through your body, pierce through your heart, pierce through your all your emotions and everything. The words, how we're going to articulate. There is a very good story about a Sufi. And he said to his disciple, go and get me the most sweetest thing in the world. So all his disciple went and brought some baklava. Then they brought some sweet. They brought some honey. All of them came in and they started sharing that treat with his master. Their master, and the master asked one of the disciples, he said, what did you bring? So he took his tongue out. And everybody started laughing at him. But the master says, no, he's right. He's absolutely right. Your tongue is the most sweetest thing you can use to say something to people. To say to your Lord, you connect with that, to your sweetness. So next morning, they all wake up and they were waiting. And he says, okay, today's task is you to bring me some of the most bitter, the most tasteless thing, So everybody went to, somebody brought a citrus, somebody brought some other sort of things which are very, very tasteless or very, very untasty. Again, same disciple. He asked, well, what did you bring? And he says, he took his tongue out again. And everybody started laughing. And I said, yeah, he's right. Your tongue is the most bitter, because that will completely pierce through with people's life. So be careful how you use your tongue. And he says, you know what? He is going to be your master when I will pass, because he has that wisdom to understand what I'm saying. So the words, what you said, the rabbi, listening to that story and saying, we can stop that music, we know what is going to happen. It's quite a significant thing. Significant. We have to be taking one step back. Now, I'm in a journey of my life where I say, okay, when I started to articulate something, I always pause and says, you know, let me gather myself before I blurt out something. Because when something has gone, it's gone. You're not going to bring it back. Same thing, when we are writing an email, we can delete everything. Even though we are writing an email, we send somebody and say, oh my God, I made a mistake. I can recall the email. But when you're saying verbally to somebody, there is no way you can bring it back. So we have to be very cautious, very conscious about what you're going to say. And that's what I gather. But today's the episode was amazing with you. You have actually touched so many things ethically, so many areas we have to ponder upon. So you, my listener, you have a treat, which you're going to listen to today. Well, today, Jonasson has actually shared his history, his journey with us, working in the school for 20 years. He's been on hitchhiking, been in Israel 9 years, studied his religion in thoroughly, and he shared a great wisdom with us today. So I say thank you very much, Jonasson, for being my guest at Chai with Sam Dosa today. And it was a pleasure having you with us today.
It has been my pleasure, Sam. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Have a fantastic day.